I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
The Starsky and Hutch Annual 1978, a book which is being devoured by the youth of Britain on this afternoon of December the 25th, 1977. Chocolate pancakes. Make a batter with 2 ounces of flour, 2 tablespoons of milk, 2 egg whites and 4 egg yolks. Add sugar and a pinch of salt, then beat well with 2 tablespoons of cream. With this batter, fry some very thin small pancakes, browning one side only. Lay them on a dish, unfried side upwards. Grate enough chocolate over them to cover tops completely. Roll them up, dust with caster sugar, put them in a long buttered fireproof dish and bake in moderate oven for 20 minutes. 375F, gas mark 5. Hey up, you pop-crazed youngsters, and it is now time for the final part of this deep dive into the 1977 Top of the Pops Christmas special. I'm here with my confederates Taylor Parks and Neil Kulkarni, and as we've learned, the ravers have lied to us, for it is not going to be a punk rock Christmas. Not now, not ever, but on we plunge.
The first number one of this year. On this very special day, Legs & Co. have invited a special friend along to help them move to the sounds of Stevie Wonder and Sir Duke.
Kid flags up the second appearance of Legs & Co. and warns us that they've brought a special friend along with them as he introduces Sir Duke by Stevie Wonder. We haven't covered Steve Lynn Morris enough on Chart Music, and this single, dedicated to Duke Ellington amongst others, became his highest performing single in the UK since Yes to Me, Yes to You, Yesterday got to number 2 in December of 1969. It was the second cut from the LP Songs in the Key of Life and follow-up to I Wish, and got to number 2 in May of this year, held off number 1 by Free by Denise Williams. And here, for their second shift, come Legs & Co. with a special appearance by Floyd Pierce, formerly of Ruby Flipper, who was popped in to take over the reins. And to paraphrase the great Schoolie D, I look into the mirror, I say, damn, Santa was a black man. It's Floyd!
Yeah, it's really something, this clip, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
I'm actually disturbed by how erotic this really is.
Mm.
We saw on last year's Christmas special that we did,
yeah,
how this time of year seemed to push some kind of switch in Flick Colby's psyche,
yes,
or libido, and inspire these routines which are authentically sexy rather than the usual chuckling parodies of sexiness, right? So last time we got that slow motion lesbian orgy in Narnia to the sound of Dancing Queen. And this year it's festive fetish night on the snowy rooftops while the city sleeps. And somehow, despite its playfulness and its overt silliness, it again inspires that deep, dark, staring silence from heterosexual male viewers, which is a response they were usually quite careful to avoid. You know, with the painted on smiles and the self-conscious air that this is only larking about. But yeah, this time it kind of hits you in parts of the body they usually try and steer clear of. But season's greetings, eh? Except I don't know whether to thank her for this, because there are certain feelings you don't necessarily need at 10 to 4 in the afternoon, surrounded by your family.
10 to 3.
You know, with your half-dead gran snoring in a torn paper app 3 feet away from you. You know, when you're trying to be a different person. And Legs and Co. were always walking a line in that titillation is about balance and control. It's a, you know, a hint of the carnal, but delivered with a friendly wink. And one step over that line can just change the mood entirely. Like actual pornography, if you leave aside the sex industry and its sometimes dubious practices, the end product, right, by which I mean, you know, any artistic or pseudo-artistic or non-artistic content which just empties the brain of everything except sex and temporarily flings open the doors of the psyche and lets all the filth pour free. That can be a healthy or an unhealthy thing depending on various factors, and the main one is context. Because it's like if you get pissed on a Friday night in a room with your mates, it's a healthy release. But if you get pissed at 10 a.m. on a Tuesday when you're driving a lorry load of nuclear waste, it's a fucking disaster. And similarly, if you open that door to your own untrammeled depravity and enter the porn dimension in private, knowing what's what, you can make peace with your own desires and celebrate them. But as soon as pornography shifts into the everyday world and brings those feelings with it, it becomes toxic because suddenly it means something totally different. And inflaming those urges, especially in men, outside a safe, controlled environment can be bad in all sorts of ways. And, you know, even for yourself, at the very least, it gnaws at the soul and at the dreary balance of responsibilities. And it's frankly depressing, you know, and it hurts a bit. And that's the trouble when anything slightly oversteps that line. So in that sense, I'm a little bit very gently perturbed by this clip coming out of the blue on Christmas Day, albeit with most of its erotic potential muffled by the bromide of a hundredweight of Christmas pudding. but, you know, also, as always with things of this nature, I have to wonder, is it just me? Like, perhaps to everyone else, this is just a delightfully saucy bit of festive fun, you know.
I don't know.
There's some strange constellation of signs which hits me at an awkward angle. And, I mean, it would be odd because I don't mind admitting to the pop craze youngsters, I'm not obsessed with pony girls and I don't have that creepy white guy thing about interracial sex. And an icy rooftop does nothing for me and I've tried, you know. But as soon as you start picking at the threads of your own sexuality, your brain starts to unravel, you know. So fuck it. People worry too much about everything to do with pleasure. The only things worth worrying about to do with pleasure are, A, is it mutual? And B, where is it? You know, everyone else expects you to worry, so you worry.
But I think in 77, this would have perturbed quite a few people for reasons completely opposite to yours, Taylor. I mean, you know, the racial politic of this, a black Santa, you know, two lines of mainly white women. And I think it becomes dead sexy down to a tiny little detail. It's the heels. The heels are really important to making it sexy. But this Black Santa with quite a flamboyant, outwardly sexual performance, these two lines of white ladies, that would have had your, you know, that would have had your gammons apoplectic, you know, before their Christmas dinner.
Oh, just to think he came into our kid's bedroom last night. But unbelievably, this is the second appearance of a Black Santa on BBC One today, and it's only fucking 3:25. Only half an hour ago on Are You Being Served, Mr. Granger won the Santa competition after he couldn't remove his makeup after playing the part of a black and white minstrel in the Grace Brothers Christmas Review.
Oh, dear God.
And Mr. Grace decided that he'd send someone out to pull a child off the streets to pick out the best Santa. And, oh, would you believe it? It was a black boy.
Holy Christ.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe some viewers would have seen this as an oblique
BBC
reference.
BBC One
to
just
that.
Ruining Christmas for us.
That, I mean, I was watching this, feeling faintly aroused, but also wondering, is it the same rooftop used by Morecambe and Wise in that, you know, the routine where they're both reindeer and Bruce Forsyth comes out the chimney at the end of it and starts whipping them? Yeah. It looks exactly the same as that.
Did that turn you on, Neil?
No comment. But, it looked like exactly the same set. I mean, the fact that we've spent sort of 5 minutes talking about this dance routine shows how effective it is, because we're not talking about the fucking amazing record that they're dancing along to.
No. And we won't for a little while longer, because, you know, Floyd, he's been, you know, he was asked out of Ruby Flipper about 14 or so months ago. But, you know, he's been quite a regular on Top of the Pops in 1977. He was always drafted in when they needed a lad. You know, he was obviously the best dancer. The best male dancer on Ruby Flipper, in any case. He'd been on Lonely Boy by Andrew Gold in April. You're Gonna Get Next to Me by Bo Kirkland and Ruth Davis in June. And I Feel Love by Donna Summer in August. Right. And here he is again. I mean, the thing that offends me, that he's only got a moustache, not a beard. What's going on there? he's got a proper Village People moustache going on, which adds a new dimension to it. But he's not really being a sexy Santa. It's not about him.
No, he's not being a sexy Santa, but I think he's being quite libidinous. He's I'm sure he nearly pinches an arse at one point.
Well, that's what I thought, but he's actually picking up one of the reins.
Yeah,
he's only indulging in light bondage, Neil. Nothing to worry about.
He's definitely closer to Clarence Carter's backdoor Santa.
All
the goodies, Father Christmas, do not touch me. Than he is to a more traditional department store.
And Legs and Co. They're in a silver bra and pants set with bits of fur hanging off the sides. They've got silver reindeer horns on a fur-lined hat, silver gloves, and matching boots. And once again, they're doing that pause-up thing that they did when portraying cats. Yeah. Their interpretation of Stray Cat Strut a few years later. I mean, with cats, you can just about get away with it, but reindeer. No. Reindeer walking on their back legs. Gah. But the performance is very Rudolph.
But most of the dancing is left to Floyd. Mostly what they do is chorus line type stuff.
Yeah.
Skipping around, because you can't really do much else in those shoes.
No.
But the shoes, to me, they're the things that improve my satisfaction quotient by a good 75%, I would say.
Yeah.
But the song's good.
The song's great.
The song's fucking amazing.
But, I mean, you know, the weird thing with Stevie is this album that it comes from, Songs in the Key of Life, is probably now my favourite Stevie record. But I remember it being the first 70s Stevie that I picked up retrospectively in the mid-80s, entranced as I was by Paul Gambaccini's 100 Greatest Albums book. I went straight to that one. And I shouldn't have, actually. Great though that album is, don't get me wrong. I should have gone to Talking Book or Inner Visions first, because there were still moments and songs in the Key of Life that I wasn't old enough to accept, in a sense, or I still had that residual distaste for 80s Stevie that I could still sort of hear there. But I mean, fuck me, what an amazing album and what a tune! If you don't dance to this, you're not a human being. It's one of those. The only thing, as an old fart fan now, is that I actually found Legs and Co's Steps, when Stevie's singing the line about Satchmo and Basie and Ella, I found them a little disrespectful, yeah, to be honest with you. I thought they should have been far more serious at that, right, point in the song. But it's a corker.
They should have just stood still and put their hands over their hearts and bowed their heads.
Well, no. I was expecting them to do like trombone-type movements and like musical instrument-type movements, but they didn't.
Although in the context of this routine, that might have looked a little bit...
even more
strange. A bit risque.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, this is the other song that takes me right back to 1977 because it just reminds me of the summer of that year, or at least the couple of weeks that my dad had time off work, and it would be the time-honoured tradition of him driving us down to the Golden Ball, locking us in the car. And I think at this point, I had a radio or something. There was a radio that wasn't the car radio, which was not allowed because it would flatten the battery. And this song was on all the fucking time. So when I hear that, I've got the taste of Apollo Cola in my mouth. And I can feel one of them little travel mastermind pegs in between my finger and thumb. That I played on my own because my sister didn't want to, which was the most futile thing ever.
That game, though, man, it's mind-blowing. Yeah. Still to this day. My brain actually couldn't cope with it sometimes.
Yeah, but there's nothing more futile than playing Travel Mastermind on your own because you've actually had to load the fucking pegs in. You either do that and know what they're going to be,
yeah,
or you do it with your eyes shut and then there's no one to tell you which ones you got right or wrong. So, yeah, fucking 70s childhood in a nutshell there, I feel. But, yeah, imagine if Santa... and Legs and Co. had to do that in every house in the world, man. It would take them fucking years to get around. Anything else to say?
Probably best to leave it there.
Yes, Taylor, yes. The follow-up, Another Star, would only get to number 25 for 2 weeks in September of this year. And if we're not counting Ebony and Ivory, and we are certainly not, he'd have to wait another 7 years before finally getting to number one with... I Just Called to Say I Love You. Floyd would make another 4 appearances in 1978, culminating in another Christmas Day stint, would appear with Legs and Co. in The Stud and join them on Larry Grayson's Generation Game before becoming a member of the Doogie Squires Dozen, who backed Lulu on her appearances on The Les Dawson Show before joining Hot Gossip.
That was, and Sir Duke.
And coming up on the show...
Sorry.
What's up now?
Oh, I've got a Lucille here.
A Lucille?
Oh, talking of Lucille, here's Kenny Rogers.
I don't believe it. You couldn't stoop so low. Not so low.
In a bar in Toledo, across from the depot, on a bar stool, she took off her ring. I thought I'd get closer, so I walked on over, I sat down and asked her the name.
Edmund stumbles into Kid, but it's not a heart attack, alas. He's doing another joke about a malfunction in his lifts because they're introducing Loose Heel by Kenny Rogers. Born in Houston in 1938, Kenny Rogers was a bassist who joined a jazz trio called the Bobby Doyle Three in the late 50s until they split up in 1965. A year later, he joined the successful folk band the New Christie Minstrels, who were at the tail end of their career and going through a string of lineup changes, including the addition of Kim Carnes, the Betty Davis Eyes hitmaker. In 1967, two of the Minstrels decided to set up on their own as a rock band called The First Edition and took Rogers with them and immediately took off in the USA. And by the time they made their first appearance in the UK charts with Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town, which got to number 2 over here for 6 weeks in December 1969, January 1970, they were known as Kenny Rogers and The First Edition. The follow-up, Something's Burning, would get to number 8 in April of 1970, but they never troubled the UK charts again, and they split up in 1976. Rodgers immediately signed a deal with United Artists, surged into the laid-back country style he'd wanted to do with the first edition for ages, and enjoyed moderate success in the country charts with his debut LP. But this single, taken from his second LP, Kenny Rogers, put him over the top, getting to number 5 in America and taking the number 1 spot in June of this year from God Save the Queen by the Sex Pistols. Oh, no, actually, it was I Don't Want to Talk About It by Rod Stewart. Wink, wink. Kenny Rogers, we get a video, and it seems to be made specially for this episode, if not for Top of the Pops.
I'm actually disturbed by how erotic this really is. No. It's weird though, isn't it? It's
really weird.
I don't know what this clip is. There's clearly not a live band playing.
No.
But there does seem to be a live vocal to begin with.
Yes.
Because you hear that roomy ambient sound on the voice. Mm. And then he walks over to the bar stool.
Yeah.
In this sort of bar where it's set. And you hear his footsteps from his black slip-on shoes with a bit of a heel on them. Mm. Then he sits down on it, and you hear the leather squash down, and the wood creaking.
Yeah,
and it's strange to go in and out of realities like that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Kenny's on his own in a posh bar, presumably in London or in the UK, because there's a bottle of Pimm's on the back bar, which there's very little call for in Toledo. Hey, boy, give me one of them PMs.
And a bottle of J&B gets a nice bit of product placement. Because it's funny, you go around the world, J&B is still one of the top brands of scotch. Mm. Whereas here, it's practically gone the same way as Cutty's Art or White Horse, which I don't get when the top-selling brand is that fucking creosote they call Bells.
Yeah.
I mean, you do see J&B now. It's in Waitrose.
Yeah.
Like, priced up like it's something fancy, you know. No, the point is, it's a pale, sweet scotch that's nice in Coke, and it's not fancy at all. Although, speaking of drinks, you saw there's a glass of orange juice on the end of that bar with maybe vodka and orange, with a stirrer in it.
Yeah.
Sort of about three-quarter full, as if there were some women in this bar, but for some reason they've left in a hurry without bothering to finish their drinks.
The backing track clearly isn't provided by the Top of the Pops Orchestra, because they would be fucking four deep at that bar. Kenny would be poking his head above them while the crisps are being ripped open.
But, I mean, the footsteps and the creaky chair are really fucking weird, aren't they? Yeah. Suits a weird record, because like Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town, this has got this broken man thing to it.
Yeah.
And Kenny Rogers with his doleful, sad, polar bear-like eyes almost. He's the perfect person to deliver it. It's a weird record.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Kenny Rogers, for me, gets mashed up with an assortment in this period, late 70s, of bearded American gentlemen, including Jock Ewing and Grizzly Adams.
Yes.
And various people. You know, he's kind of indistinguishable from these people. And it's a weird song anyway. When the singer of the song witnesses, you know, Lucille's husband imploring her, you know, about four hungry children and a crop in the field.
Yeah, that's,
it's a strange, strange song.
That's impressive cock blocking, isn't it?
What is the crop? I mean, if it's sorghum or tobacco, then I guess he can't feed his kids. But if he could, like, just harvest it himself, he could fucking feed his kids, you lazy bastard. So it's a weird song, this, with a really, I mean, this has got to be the strangest thing I've seen on Top of the Pops in a long, long time.
Yes.
Just by dint of that creakiness, what is happening here? Are we hearing the record? Are we hearing, as a kid, this would have put me in loads of confusion.
Yeah, it's this particular strain of music, it's generally overlooked now a bit, isn't it? Because it's not pure old-fashioned country, so it's no good for hipsters. And it's not really country rock. It's just that very straight, radio-friendly, middle-of-the-road country pop, which was country music as far as the mainstream country audience was concerned for many years.
I mean, country was huge in Britain in 1977. There was always, you know, Sing Country and all that kind of stuff was on BBC Two. Essentially down to Ted, Mams and Dance calming down a bit, but still wanting something American.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then as now. It was huge in America, but almost underground at the same time.
Mm.
You know, like these people selling out, you know, 30,000-seater places and no one's ever heard of them.
Yeah.
You know? There's still people like that now. And, you know, maybe you couldn't make it through a whole album of this stuff, at least not by the same artiste, but it's a genre where a lot of really great singles can be found.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is what gave us Jolene, you know, this style of music. And that and Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town. And this isn't quite up there, but it's okay. And if you're not too squeamish about big guts hanging over big belts and, you know, the self-pitying tears of the great American patriarch, then I don't see what there is to dislike about this record. I mean, there's oceans of worthless mainstream 1970s adult-orientated country that you can swim through before you get to genuinely talented people like Kenny Rogers.
The best way to access that kind of music, great 70s country, is buy a compilation with a cowboy on the front of it or something like that. That'll be called Country's Greatest Hits. It's guaranteed to have, like, Joe South games people play on it, and it'll have Dolly Parton, Coat of Many Colours on it, maybe, and also Jolene. But it will also have Find Time to Leave Me, Lucille, and it will probably also have Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town on it. Because some of those 70s country singles are fucking brilliant.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But the thing about it, popular country music, it's a straightforward force. Do you know what I mean? It's bluff, and it's kind of artless in a way.
Mm.
And some people are uncomfortable with that. Or they're so terrified of the idea of the southern US white proletariat that just the sound of a pedal steel, it's like a fistful of rings swinging at you, you know what I mean? Which is a bit unfair to most of the country greats, not quite all of them, but most of them.
Mm.
What I like about this, like the ABBA record, it's unusual in that it only makes sense emotionally to adults.
Mm.
Although, unlike that song, this one is hard to take completely seriously. Just the idea that you would tell this story like this, right? It was basically, I was chatting up this woman in a bar, and while I was doing it, her husband came in, and they separated while I was sat there chatting her up. And he was visibly heartbroken. And then, how weird is this? When he then left, and we immediately afterwards went off to fuck, it just didn't feel quite right.
Mm.
Oh, what's wrong with me? You know, it's
a
very strange scenario.
Yeah.
And it's hard to gauge how seriously you're meant to take it. I mean, I suspect 100%, but I can't be absolutely sure. But it does chime for those over 35 in a way it couldn't for luckier people.
Yeah.
Because there's just that feel of genuine tiredness with life and a sort of hard Jack Reaganish acceptance of the world, of a romantic world where everyone, including yourself, looks a bit rough and is damaged physically and emotionally.
Mm.
And that's quite unpop. And obviously the genius of ABBA is that they can pull it off within pop and the very best pop, whereas no one involved with this record is a genius. But it's nice to have a bit of that sometimes when somebody can properly pull it off, you know.
And the ending, sorry, is really, really key because it ends with a note of moral doubt and impotence, basically. He can't get it up because he's thinking of this guy's walked out. It's a similarly startling ending to you know, the last line of Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town, that for God's sake turn around line. It's such an odd end to a record and it's got the same sort of feel here.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a much better kind of adult music than the usual kind, right, for proper grown-ups, which is usually just a symptom of surrender to all the avoidable calamities of midlife, right, like complacency and cosiness and loss of focus and loss of self-awareness. And this isn't that. Whatever else you can say about it, you know, this is a record which has come to terms with the unavoidable calamities of midlife and with scars and grey whiskers, you know. But it can still feel like the king of the castle if it just has one little drink, you know. And that's probably easier to do in country music, not just because it's a pretty age-tolerant genre, but emotionally because it's got that grounded feel and the reassuring inevitability of the melody lines, which always resolve and don't make a fuss. And within that setup and that security musically, you feel as though you can face almost anything. Mm. You know?
And again, like many country songs that were hits around about this time, you know, you're hooked in by the story on the first listen.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Not so much the 7th or 8th or 9th or 27th time you hear it, of course. But, you know, there you go. Oh, Uncle Jesse in the Dukes of Hazzard as well, Neil.
Uncle Jesse, of course.
Yeah. So Lucille would only stay at number one for 1 week, taken down by Show You the Way to Go by the Jacksons. The follow-up, Daytime Friends, would only get to number 39 in September of this year, and he drifted away from the charts until Coward of the County got to number one for 2 weeks in February of 1980.
With four hungry children and a crop in the field, I've had some bad times, lived through some sad times, but this time you heard it.
Yes, Kenny Rogers, of course, and Lucille. I hope you're enjoying this review of 77, Christmas Day edition of Top of the Pops. Let's go on with the number one sound from Baccarat.
Edmonds hopes that we're having a lovely afternoon, which is nice, and introduces Yes Sir I Can Boogie by Baccarat. We've already covered Baccarat, Baccarat, hoo hoo hoo, I thought it was the Osmonds, fuck off Edmonds! And this song on chart music number 23, mm-hmm. With us three. It got to number one in October of this year after wrestling David Soul and Silver Lady off the toppermost of the poppermost, and here they are again. So, yeah, this was always going to happen at some point, wasn't it, chaps?
Mm, yeah.
Yeah.
There are going to be songs that crop up on separate episodes, but usually it's like, oh, well, you know, there's someone else here who hasn't talked about it, but, you know, here we are. We've already talked about this, so
yeah,
let's get it over with quickly.
I wouldn't have minded if it was a song that I liked, but I don't like this. I still don't like this song much.
Yeah.
But Christ, by now, at the end of the year, on Christmas Day, if I were an adult, I would have hated this record. Yes, it's catchy. Yeah. Yes, it Velcro-like attaches itself to your brain. But by the year's end, that would just be annoying. I would have heard this far, far too much. And the performance would have annoyed me as well, because I don't understand the hand gesture for the word boogie. They both do. I don't know what they're doing with that. I would have disliked this record when it came out earlier in the year, and I would have been angered by the fact that it's cropped up on Top of the Pops at the end of the year too.
Mm. All I've got to chuck in is nice set, some kind of rainbowy thing going on, and no Top of the Pops orchestra this time. So we just get I think they just mime into the track.
Yeah, probably for the best.
Yeah.
Basically, just, go and listen to whatever... Chart music
number 23, a classic episode, if I may say so myself. Soul Rail Replacement Service.
Yeah, the only difference basically between that and this is they've changed their outfits.
Yeah.
And now look even more like extras in a low budget 1970s Euro horror film. So basically, it was either this or turn up topless and immaculately made up with a steak knife sticking out of the sternum and with a shabby, poorly dubbed detective standing over him going, "This killer is a sexual deviant. The taking of human life excites him." You know, that all being hosed down naked in a women's prison. Mm. So it's probably fortunate for them that they could boogie, even if they're not actually going to.
So, Yes Sir, I Can Boogie would only stay at number one for 1 week before it was slapped down by Name of the Game by ABBA. The follow-up, Sorry I'm a Lady, would get to number eight in February of 1978, and they were done as a chart act in the UK. I can boogie.
Great Big Owl.
What?
Great Big Owl.
Stop saying that. What about Great Big Owl?
It's a family of podcasts.
Ooh. Who's in this family?
Well, there's Rule of Three. That's us.
There's Brian and Roger.
Hi, Roger. It's Brian.
There's the One Show Show.
There's nowhere else you would find a 4 or 5 minute film about pine martins.
Yes.
Without a sight of one pine martin at all in the film.
There's Barry and Angelos.
Oh, Gooch, Gooch, Chooch. Yeah. Remember that lovely one?
And there's Smirch Pod.
Could you eat first? I think we know.
Well, I know. I don't know if I want to eat Lazenby.
Basically, look for Great Big Owl on your pod, what's it?
Good idea. Have we got a sting?
Owls don't sting.
Great Big.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And I know the Paul McCartney family will be celebrating their Christmas up in Scotland in a big way this year, because they're still at number one in their beautiful Mull of Kintyre.
Mull of Kintyre. My desire is always to be on Mull of Kintyre.
Kid claims to know that the McCartney family are simply having a wonderful Christmas time, when for all he knows, Paul could be going berserk that John hasn't sent him a card again, as he introduces Mull of Kintyre by Wings. We've covered Wings in chart music more than once, and this is their 15th single. It's the follow-up to their live cover of Maybe I'm Amazed, which got to number 28 for 2 weeks in March of this year and was scheduled as a stopgap single while the band were recording their 6th LP, London Town, after the band was reduced to a trio due to two of them pissing off. It's a tribute to Paul McCartney's back garden. It features the Campbelltown Pipe Band, and after entering the charts at number 48 in November, it soared to number 5 the following week and got to number 1 in early December, and it's now celebrating its 4th week there as this year's Christmas number 1. Oh, where to start on this one?
Bloody hell.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? This is a record you quite often hear, but almost nobody ever actually listens to.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, for fairly good reason. But when you do stop and listen and take it in, a few things are suddenly clear, right? Firstly, even at his worst, Paul McCartney is a genius in the same way as other sometimes evil genii that we've previously identified, like Elton John, right? But more so. Mm. Like, this record has got no artistic worth, but it became an instant standard. For many years, this was the best-selling single of all time in Britain without any external driver, like a charity connection or a tie-in to a major event or something. And that really doesn't happen by accident. I mean, this is an insultingly simple and unexciting song, but with no effort or care, he's created something which does stick in your head, does have a strong melody, albeit, you know, strong in the same way as the smell of rotting cat food, and and just feels like a massive and hugely popular hit. A simple, worthless smash hit is something that every idiot thinks they could create themselves until they try it. And the other thing that strikes you when you properly listen to this is that, like so many Paul McCartney songs, its supposedly simple and direct emotional appeal is all pretend, and it's all emerging from a mask. It's a song of nostalgia for a Highland past, which is not his. He's in character, sneakily, as usual. Like Sweet Through the Heather, like Deer in the Glen, Carry Me Back to the Days I Knew Then. It's like he only bought this place as a tax dodge, you know, and he hardly went there until the 70s. And he's coming on like a kilted old laird in a leather armchair, you know, underneath a painting of his great-grandfather, banging his stick on the ground. And so rarely could Paul McCartney say anything in song, even something as basic as, I like my house in the country.
Yes.
It's dead nice up there. Without doing this, without creating a cut-out character.
Oh, God, yeah, this is country house of the 70s, isn't it?
But it this brings you to the third thing that you realise when you listen to this record, which is a familiar thought to Wings watchers. It's just, what the fuck did he think he was doing?
Mm.
It's like, what was going on in his long head? It's Paul McCartney is still alive because he stayed sane.
Mm.
And to do that, he first had to go slightly mad and then maintain that level of insanity, right? I think if Paul McCartney hadn't been this weird, he may have been yet another casualty of rock.
Mm. Mm.
So this is the price we pay for his continued happiness.
There is an evil genius. No, maybe not necessarily evil, but there is a genius to this record. I mean, I'd like to stress I don't like it. And by the end of the year of 77, you could not buy a chart compilation without this on it, front and centre.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember at the time liking it initially, as you do, and then hating it. It's perhaps my first apprehensions at a young age. As it was with the similar, in a way, Sailing by Rod Stewart, that a song that sticks around and doesn't go anywhere, and I don't mean go anywhere within the song, I mean it just stays at the fucking top of the charts for ages. Because this is like 4 weeks in now, number one, and it's got another 5 weeks, hasn't it, I think?
Yes, it has,
So that can get massively annoying. And also at that age, I had utter confusion about the lyrics. I didn't know what a Mull of Kintyre was. No. And I didn't even realise it was a place to a certain extent. But yeah, like Taylor says, apart from Charity Records and Death Records, this was the biggest selling UK single of all time. And it is the genius of Paul, I think, to hit upon something really special. And that's the ability to make a song that would appeal to people who don't even like music.
Or Scotland.
But I mean, people who perhaps did not buy a record that year will have bought this because its tune is simple and it returns. Mm. It's infantile melodically in a way, just two chords. The bagpipes would have reassured that kind of silent majority audience that this record had as well. I mean, obviously...
It's Amazing Grace again, isn't it?
Yeah, this is it. And it's a simple song with single-syllable words, mainly. And it feels less... What Paul manages to do is create a song here that feels like it has existed before, in a way. And that's really... You know, that is an incredibly difficult thing to do. I absolutely don't ever want to hear it again. But I can understand why in the bleak midwinter of 77, a song about home, a song about getting home and going home and loving your home would have been appealing, especially when couched in such a musically instantly understandable and simple form as this. So I begrudgingly, I think all of us have to begrudgingly, you know, nod our heads that Paul was a genius at doing this kind of thing, of creating these records that didn't just appeal. It's not even important that whether it appealed to people like us or music fans. This was just a record that kind of all sorts of people could buy into. And that's why it was so hugely successful. It's a real skill doing that.
McCartney would spend most of the 80s trying to have the big Christmas hit.
Mm.
You know, as Simon said, in a previous chart music when we did Pipes of Peace, I think it was Simon, you know, he really wanted to be part of your Christmas.
Yeah.
And this did the trick for him big style because it's a convivial song. It is an arms round your mates in the pub, sway along kind of thing.
Also, it's
British country music, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think part of my problem is that I don't feel the Scottishness of it in a nice way. I mean, despite my... starey pale blue eyes and unhealthy complexion suggesting I have at least some Scottish blood. I'm not really a fan of the Scottish Highlands. I mean, appealing as the country looks post-election, those big empty misty hills and rocks which people find so good for the soul, it just looks like death to me. I don't want to be there.
Do you like shortbread?
I'm not allowed to eat it anymore. Oh. It's just, it gets worse. I mean, but the worst moment of this record, of course, is when the pipes come in.
Mm.
But, I mean, that's the worst moment of any given day. And it's it's all the worse for that warning blast you get first, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is like the scream of a doodle bug, like informing you that you're
get
in
under
for
the
it.
Table.
Yeah, and it's that same feeling of rapidly gathering misery as when you hear upstairs washing machine going onto the spin cycle. So you know something horrible's coming. And then the fucking pipers walk on, and I just... Every one of those bastards belongs in a transparent plastic tube
yes.
on sale next to a tin of shortbread, a gonk in a tam o'shanter,
yes.
A jigsaw of Cumbernauld Old Town Centre, and a packet of novelty Elastoplast bearing the slogan Glasgow's Miles Better.
Yes.
And I don't think they're even very good pipers. I don't even know that there is such a thing, but I do know that he just went down to the nearest town and yeah. got the local pipe band. He didn't seek out the kings of the bagpipe scene.
No.
You know. So for all I know, to a bagpipe connoisseur, this might sound pretty much like it sounds to the rest of us.
Yeah.
Like 20 pneumatic drills heard through a concussion. But what I do know is that being Paul, tight as an otter's pocket, he paid them about £20 each,
yes.
which is fair enough. And you do only get a flat fee for session work, and there are quite a lot of them. But it's quite funny considering that it sold about 10 million copies an hour, and they would still have been eating bannocks in front of a 3-bar fire in black and white, like 2 miles away from his house.
I mean, we get the video for this, which is Paul wandering through the mist, playing his guitar until he's joined by Denny Lane, also playing his guitar. And then they both discover Linda sitting on a rock, and then the pipe band wander through, and then it essentially becomes a living shortbread tin, doesn't it?
It's a big set. It's a big, big set. It makes
it's a shame he couldn't get Ringo to pretend to be all woolly and sit on a bucket in the distance.
This is ostensibly kind of like a down... Not a down-home song, but it's a simple little song. But the set belies that, because it's huge. It's just a big, yes. big video, you know. And
it's a big country, Neil.
It is a big country. But, I mean, you know, I wondered why they couldn't, like, film it in the genuine Highlands. I'm guessing because it wouldn't have looked quite as nice. It wouldn't have looked as shortbread tinny, as you say. And I wonder how this record went down in Scotland as such. But I remember hearing it an awful lot. And at the time, I was living in an area of Coventry called Stoke Aldermore that was sort of not notorious as such, but it was an area that had a massive, massive sort of Scottish expat population in that part of Coventry. And I remember it just hearing it an awful lot. Maybe not because of those people, but maybe because of those people. You know, if you're adrift in England, then the sound of the pipes, I guess, the sound of that
calling
song...
calling you, wouldn't they?
Well, I'm guessing that was part of its appeal anyway. But that certainly doesn't account for all of its appeal. I think, its appeal is mainly it's a piece of music designed to appeal to people who don't even like music.
Those bagpipes, though, don't you think that they sound just like the guitars in big country records? It's amazing.
Tell you what, I really feel for my homie Denny Lane. That professional gooseberry, just, you know, like third wheel. And he's just walking out of the mist with his mind on that co-writing credit, trying to block everything else out, you know, this grotesque parody of Scottishness, English style, like averting his eyes from Linda's tartan pop socks and smiling manfully as he, you know, sings this song and tries to recall those happy times in Paul's post-apocalyptic farmhouse on the Mull of Kintyre. Because, I mean, it might possibly be done up quite nice now, but notoriously, back in the 70s, he didn't have electricity in there or anything or any heating.
Mm.
And he dragged the various lineups of Wings up there to stay, because they'd do pre-tour rehearsals there with a generator in the barn. And he'd make them sleep in empty brick buildings on stained mattresses.
I did it at Amberg. If it's good enough for me, it's good enough for you.
Yeah, I mean, famously, the road crew once got so bored and unhinged and cold that they painted the outline of a television on the bare brick wall and sat around watching it. Meanwhile, Scrooge McCartney and Linda were in the main cottage, sat by the fire. And if it got really cold, they'd light it. But Denny's problem was that his missus and Linda McCartney fucking hated each other. Because Linda knew that she'd started off as a groupie trying to have it off with Paul. And was maybe a little bit younger and prettier. And it was all a bit awkward, apparently, in that unimaginable paradise of privilege and wealth and security. So, yeah, I always feel a little bit for Denny Lane, stuck on the private jet with all the kids running around screaming. It's like he was half a rock star, you know what I mean?
And, of course, this essentially ushers in 1978, which was the most Scottish year ever.
Oh, yeah.
Up until the first half of the Peru game, of course. You know, people forget that this was a double A-side.
It was a double A-side in the same way that Wham was a duo. And Gummo was one of the Marx Brothers.
Girls' School.
Yeah, it was a great song called Girls' School, which was written after Macca was passing time on an aeroplane on tour, looking at adverts for dirty movies in the back of a magazine. Mm-hmm. And he decided to write a song, which was a synopsis of a porno film about a convent that he had made up in his head. Now, presumably, he thought this was a good idea to put something raunchy and rocky on the B-side of Muller Kintyre to protect the countercultural image he may still have imagined that he had. Or perhaps more because he thought American radio might have one listen to Muller Kintyre and think, what the Sam Hill is this? I think he was right about that as well, because I don't think it was a very big hit in America. But the upshot was, millions of grannies ended up with a record in their collection, even if they never played that side, with the opening line, sleepyhead kid sister lying on the floor, 18 years and younger boy, well, she knows what she's waiting for. Now, is that a good thing? Not especially, but it is the kind of cultural detail that, you know, enlivens the overcast pop charts of 1977 and underlines what a terribly confusing person Paul McCartney really was, like eternally bemusing and impossible to fully understand.
And of course, I've got a bit more fondness for this than you, because this is the introductory music at Forest games.
Is it?
Yes. Wow. Yeah, because around about this time when Forest were breaking the rest of Division One over their knee, the Terrace song was City Ground, All Mist Rolling In from the Trent.
Oh.
You see, and they still play it now. So you go to a Forest game, Muller Kintyre will come on and everyone will stand up and belt it out, and then they'll sit down and be dead quiet for the next 2 hours or so.
Yeah.
Because football's rubbish nowadays.
Tell you what was bothering me for ages. Has there been a number one since this in waltz time? And I thought about
good
it.
Good point.
Eventually I thought of one. Mistletoe and Wine.
Oh.
Right, a record whose one good point is that it allows you to appreciate the artistry and charm of Muller of Kintyre.
Muller of Kintyre would spend 9 weeks at number one, giving way to the majesty of Uptown Top Ranking by Althea and Donna in the last week of January 1978. It would become the first single to sell over 2 million copies in the UK and currently stands as the fourth best-selling single in Britain after Candle in the Wind 1997, Do They Know It's Christmas and Bohemian Rhapsody, and is still the biggest-selling non-charity single when you knock out the sales figures of the 1991 re-release of Bohemian Rhapsody. The follow-up, With a Little Luck, got to number five in April of 1978, but diminishing returns began to set in and Denny Lane would leave Paul and Linda to get on with it in April of 1981.
Oh,
nearly perfect for this time of year, but sadly that about winds up our festive feast of past hit 45s on the programme. I'm glad I got that out. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as us.
Don't forget, 3:25 tomorrow on BBC One for the Boxing Day edition and more hits from 77. We leave you with what probably is the biggest-selling Christmas record of all time. Bing Crosby, of course, and White Christmas. Bye-bye.
Merry Christmas.
Of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know.
Kid and Edmonds stand neath the tree. Show part two of Top of the Pops 1977, which will be on tomorrow, and sign off with What Else? White Christmas by Bing Crosby. Born Harry Crosby Jr. in Tacoma, Washington in 1903, Bing Crosby was America's highest grossing performer of the 30s and 40s, and this is his biggest hit song from a career spanning 46 years. It was written by Irving Berlin, either in Hollywood or Phoenix, nobody can remember, in 1940, and it was immediately bagged by Crosby, who sang it for the first time in public on the NBC radio show The Kraft Music Hall on Christmas Day 1941, and then forgotten about for a few months when Crosby recorded it when he was doing the soundtrack for his forthcoming film Holiday Inn, which was released in August of that year. When the film came out, the single immediately got to number one in America at the end of October and would stay there right through the year. But seeing as our charts wouldn't begin for another 10 years, there is no record of how it did over here. 2 months before this episode, Crosby died of a heart attack on a golf course near Madrid, so it was blatantly obvious that the single was going to be re-released, and it's currently at number 5 in the chart. But it's the 1947 re-recording, which was made because the master of the original single had been worn out through countless repressings during World War II. And we don't get a clip from either Holiday Inn or White Christmas, the 1954 film that was on BBC One yesterday afternoon. We get to contemplate some oversized balloons, don't we, that show what he had finished with.
Yeah, yeah. And by this point, to be honest with you, age 5, I would have been out of the room by now. I would have been setting up my streak track, heard this song too many times. It's only as you get older you realise, you know, Bing Crosby's actually, for several reasons, a really pivotal figure in the history of pop music and in the history of recording music, and in particular his development of the microphone and that close and intimate conversational crooning style is really important. His support of John Mullen, who bought back magnetophones from post World War II Germany, and then his passing on of those machines to Les Paul was hugely important, hugely important. And the radio show that you mentioned is obviously, it's perhaps the first radio show to be using tape technology to erase things like dead air and to start using things like canned laughter. So he's really important in the development of recorded sound. I just don't like any of the sounds that he recorded, including this record, which is such a standard. It's beyond critical analysis. It's beyond any analysis. It is just there. It is White Christmas. It is going to be part of everyone's Christmas. You're probably going to hear it in the next few weeks. There it is.
Yeah, no, I'm exactly the same. By this point in this Top of the Pops, there would have been chocolate fingerprints on the Beano book. And Bing would have been crooning this to an empty beanbag and an untouched bowl of walnuts. I've never been a fan of Bing Crosby, although, he was, you know, arguably the first modern singer. Because he doesn't project. He sings in a way that you only could in the 20th century because of the, you know, electronic wizardry allowing him to stand in front of a full orchestra and sing quietly. You know, it's like when movie actors suddenly realised they didn't have to mug like David Soul singing a ballad because the audience were not 40 feet away anymore. But yeah, I'm not a big fan of Bing Crosby apart from his name. And you know, his first wife was called Dixie. Do you imagine, I was just off for cocktails at Bing and Dixie's.
Yes.
But it's It is weird at the end of this episode to suddenly, even such a ballad-heavy episode as this, to suddenly hear someone with a proper voice singing, singing a carefully crafted song. And it all seems very laboured and wheezy, which will be how it sounded to the people of 1977. But nothing better illustrates the triumph of pop by this point in history. But, you know, you gain something, you lose something. There aren't too many pop, or, you know, post-rock and roll melodicists who could write such an elegant and effortlessly dreamy hook as the first two lines of this song. Like the gentle tensions and yearning and the rise and fall in the music whilst being so simple. I guess Brian Wilson, you know, Burt Bacharach, maybe Paul McCartney, although not this year. But at the same time, no pop record has ever sounded this stiff and repressed, because it's 1942 and you can't really be anything else in public now, you know. And of course, when he says he's dreaming of a white Christmas, he's not fucking joking, because it doesn't get much whiter than this record, which is odd considering it was written by a Russian Jewish songwriter. But, you know, probably a majority of 20th century all-American culture is the result of Jewish creativity. It was mostly Jewish immigrants and their families who dragged the old, you know, hymn-singing, country-whooping America into the 20th century and built its modern cultural identity. But it's hard to really feel Irving Berlin songs now if you're not American, because there's no link and there's no line from there to here. So you end up admiring the craft, but thinking, you know, come on, put a donk on it, or whatever. You know what I mean?
Before Charlie Chaplin snuffed it earlier today, Bing Crosby was the last massive celebrity death of 1977, of which there were quite a few. I mean, everyone in your family would have suffered a musical loss in 1977. Your mum and dad grieving over Elvis. If you had an older sister, Mark Bolan. But Bing Crosby really hit home to Nonna and Grandpa, I feel. And so it's quite apt that this episode ends with this song, because it's this episode, if nothing else, has been the triumph of the grandparents, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. And it's interesting you mention those names. You know, what you have to ask, there's been nary a mention of Elvis, you know.
Yeah, that's unbelievable, isn't
it? Which is odd. I mean, I don't know whether the Boxing Day episode was a, you know, featured Elvis.
Well, Way Down was on it.
Right, I see. But it's so odd, because, I mean, it goes to show that I don't think Elvis's audience in this country was being catered for by Top of the Pops anymore. Do you know what I mean? They were kind of like, Top of the Pops wasn't for them anymore.
To be fair to the BBC, they'd already rammed Elvis up your arse right through Christmas, because they'd put one of his films on every morning.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, to me, 1977, the key event of 1977 is Elvis dying. Far more important than the Silver Jubilee or anything else. So, yeah, it is very strange not to have the King paying a visit on us on this Christmas day. But, you know, RCA didn't seem to think to release Blue Christmas, which is just the fucking most obvious thing to do. And and Bing Crosby's record label were obviously a lot more savvier.
Yeah.
It was down to Danny Mirra to speak for all of us.
Yes. And it is a very weird choice in that there's two film versions of this song, and BBC have elected to use neither of them. But I think they probably did the right thing not showing the clip from the film White Christmas, because there is that bit where he takes his pipe and plays the baubles on the Christmas tree, which would have caused a lot of breakages in houses across the country this afternoon. So White Christmas would go on to sell an estimated 50 million copies as a single, and 100 million if you factor in its many appearances on compilation LPs. It would be his first solo top 40 hit in the UK since 1957, and his last. But the previous night, his last ever TV show, Bing Crosby's Merry Old Christmas, was screened on ITV, featuring Twigger, Ron Moody, Stanley Baxter, and the duet sung by Crosby and David Bowie, Peace on Earth, Little Drummer Boy, which was released 5 years later and got to number three on Christmas week of 1982. And that concludes this episode of Top of the Pops. What's on telly afterwards? Well, BBC One pile into the Queen's speech, where she thanks everyone for giving her arse an extra special lick this year, and then gets stuck into Billy Smart's Christmas circus, The Wizard of Oz, and then Basil Through the Looking Glass, the Lewis Carroll tale recast by the King of Foxes himself. After 5 minutes of news, it's a Songs of Praise family carol special from the Royal Albert Hall, the Christmas Generation game, the Mike Yarwood Christmas show with special guest Paul McCartney and Wings, and then the last ever Morecambe and Wise Christmas show on the BBC, featuring Angela Rippon getting her legs out again, Arthur Lowe, John Le Mesurier and John Laurie in a sauna, the There's Nothing Like a Dame number with practically every male BBC presenter of the era, and Elton John singing in a deserted studio at the end. Those last two shows pulled down 28 million viewers, by the way. After the news, with Angela Rippon, they finish off the night with the 1968 Barbara Streisand film Funny Girl. BBC Two is running Alpha Omega, the Bruno Bazzetto cartoon about the life of a man from childhood to old age, followed by the Lively Arts in Performance, where the Marseille Opera and the Ballet de Marseille have a go at Coppelia. Then it's In Deepest Britain, a documentary about some geese on the south coast. Then Celebration, a clip show about the Jubilee, a repeat of the Queen's speech, the 1976 Australian film Storm Boy, about a lad who looks after some pelican chicks. Then a repeat of Thanks for the Memory, a collection of clips of the general public talking about telly and their memories of it over the past 25 years. Then it's A Christmas Past, a collection of homemade movie clips from the 20s and 30s, followed by Country Holiday with Crystal Gayle, Larry Gatlin and George Hamilton IV, and they round off the day with the 1946 Humphrey Bogart film The Big Sleep. ITV gets the Queen's speech out of the way before Frank Muir introduces To See Such Fun, a clip show of British comedy films from the 40s to the 60s. Then it's Emu's Christmas Adventure, featuring Arthur Lowe, Jack Douglas and Henry McGee. Then the news, then the Muppet Show with our very special guest star, Julie Andrews. After a seasonal sale of the century, it stars on Christmas Day, a festive episode of Stars on Sunday, which shoehorns a clip of Bing Crosby from last year amongst contributions by Gracie Fields, John Mills, Harry Secombe and Don Estelle. Then it's the evening film, the 1972 biopic Young Winston, which is on for nearly 3 hours. After the news, it's Stanley Baxter's Greatest Hits, and they close out the night with Celebration, more God-bothering from Wales, and a Christmas message from Dr. Donald Coggan, the Archbishop of Canterbury. Fucking hell. So much religious ramble on the telly. What's going on?
What's going on with Young Winston for 3 hours as well? Jeez Louise.
I know. ITV have...
They've blown it.
ITV have ballsed it up this year, man. BBC One all the way in our arse, that'd be.
Fucking hell. Imagine something going on for 3 hours. Nobody's going to make it through the whole of that.
But I mean, they're probably looking at Morecambe and Wise, Mighty Yarwood, just thinking, BBC have this, you know, doesn't matter what we put on, let's just put on some shite that's cheap.
So, me boys, what are we talking about while we're trying not to fall off our skateboards in the street this afternoon?
Seriously, not a lot. Maybe Magic Fly.
Mm.
Maybe. But there's nothing to snag you here as a young person.
No.
It's for grannies and granddads.
Yeah.
So yes. I don't think I'd have been talking. I'd probably been talking about how rubbish it was.
Yeah. Total lack of anything outrageous, even playfully. So unless you count Legs and Co. pride all up in Baker foil knickers. But other than that, yeah, this is a slump. this is a Christmas afternoon slump.
And what are we buying with our record tokens on Boxing Day? If the record shop's open on Boxing Day, it might not be.
ABBA. Denise and maybe Space.
Yeah, same. But that's about it because I'm not made of money.
And what does this episode tell us about 1977? apart from the total domination of punk.
Well, that's the major thing. Pop is still triumphant in a sense, although it's not really pop. I mean, pop in the strictly popular sense, if you like. So we have these dreary, slow, undanceable records that have dominated the year by David Soul, by Wings, by, you know, these records for people who kind of perhaps aren't into pop music that much. Pop goes on. Punk is a minority concern and doesn't even get close to this episode.
Yeah.
You know, and I suspect that even if a punk band had a number two or number one hit that wasn't God Save the Queen, I don't think they'd have got on. It would have interfered with the vibe of this show, especially because the vibe of the show is odd and haunted because it's a deserted studio. So punk was never going to work in that sort of scenario anyway.
No.
So rumours of the punkness of 1977, though, to ex-punks may be really, really important. To the rest of Britain, yeah, there weren't that many punks about. There was just one house, the punk house, and that was it.
Well, I mean, if you looked at this, you'd think, fucking hell, weren't you allowed in record shops under the age of 35 in 1977?
Yeah. Yeah, and you'd have no clue what had happened in that year that was interesting. You'd also have no clue as to what's going to happen in 78.
Yeah. I mean, this because they've split it up into two parts.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of good shit that we would have had an absolute ball talking about in that episode. You know, I Feel Love, Way Down, you know, stuff like that. But this one, it is proper fucking non-R bait. The good old pops, if you will. And that, me ducks, is the end of this episode of Chart Music. All that remains for me to say now is www.chart-music.co.uk. You can get us on facebook.com/chartmusicpodcast. Reach out to us on Twitter at chartmusictotp and shove some money down that G-string at patreon.com/chartmusic. Thank you, Taylor Parks.
Let the magic of Christmas bring God's peace to you and yours and to the world.
Ta ever so, Neil Kulkarni.
Merry Christmas out and a Happy New Year to all Chart Music listeners.
And on behalf of Simon Price, Sarah B and David Stubbs, my name's Al Needham. We'll see you at some point in January. But until then, stay pop crazed.
Chart Music.
In association with the British Market Research Bureau and the Pop Craze Patreons, the Chart Music Top 40 of 2019. At number 40, Daddisfaction. Number 39, it's Tito Jackson's Bollocks. The number 38 act of the year, Bummers Like Duran Duran.
Good lads.
In at 37, Mark Chapman and the Bullets. At 36, the Sikh Lad at a Show Waddy Waddy. At number 35, the Erotic Dreams of Mrs. Slocum.
Nice.
Number 34, Oasis. At number 33, it's Neil Cougar Kulkarni.
Got in.
There at number 32, the Gug City Slaggers are residing in the number 31 slot, Pig Wanker General. Into the top 30, and at number 30, it's Soul Rail Replacement Service. Number 29, the definitive non-sandwich band. Residing at number 28, the Granny Claps. Number 27, Mad Phil and the Gummy Woman.
Good to see.
They're at number 26, Serving Suggestion.
Yes.
At number 25, it's Gammony Sludge. Number 24, the Queen's Fanny. Standing at number 23 this year, 7 Days Jankers. In at number 22, Granny Wants Your Spunk. At number 21, the Whiff of the Catamite. Into the top 20 and at number 20, Quo Waddy Waddy. At number 19, it's Tony Blackburn and the Gay Ones. Remember this from earlier in the year? Number 18, the Alligators with Tits. At number 17, Floella Benjamin in a Dustbin. At number 16, the Doolies with Ghoulies. At number 15, Simon Price and the Receptionist from Hong Kong Fuhe.
Yes.
At number 14, Lesbian Door Factory.
Not bad for a free flexi.
A former number one at number 13, Hot Rex. In at number 12, Fred Westlife. At number 11, it's Dave D, Creeper, Twat and Cunt. The top 10 for 2019 goes like this. At number 10, Jeff Sex. At number 9, Man to Man Meet Al Needham. At number 8, Clit Richard. This year's number 7 act, Chicken Steven. At number 6, Taylor Parks's 20 Romantic Moments. The number 5 sound of the year, Sarah B and Rakim. At number 4, it's Bergerac meets Rockers Uptown.
Easy now.
At number 3, here comes Jism. At number 2, Your Dark Mate, which means
Britain's number 1.
The number 1 act of 2019, it could only be Bomber Dog. My name's Al Needham. That was 2019 for Chart Music. We'll see you next year. Stay pop crazed.
GreatBigOwl.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.